In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Thursday, September 25th, 2014. I've got a short episode for you guys today, but I thought you might be interested to hear my recent conversation with Ron Paul over on Voices of Liberty, which I hope you'll check out. It's Ron's new venture, voicesofliberty.com. Brings together a lot of important voices you might not otherwise hear. And once you start hearing them, you say, my goodness, you're right. Doggone it, Woods is right, as usual. I should be listening to Voices of Liberty. Of course, Ron is the voice of liberty, but he's graciously allowed a good many of us, including myself, to be other voices over on Voices of Liberty. Well, I was actually on his program, and we talked about various things. My book is not yet out, you know, Real Dissent, so the timing was not ideal, really. I would like to come back on and talk about the book when it's available, but we talked about libertarianism and answering the critics, and we talked about foreign policy, and I think maybe you'll like what we had to say. So here we go, and enjoy.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in today. We have a special guest, somebody that most of you know, Tom Woods. Tom, thank you for being with us.
Ron, a pleasure always.
Tom and I have worked together for a good many years now. He even came to Washington. I know he loves Washington. He even went and testified before a government committee. But I'd like to think that he only came there because I was on that committee, the financial services, and had something to do with the Fed. I was looking his resume up and his bio, and I find out that he's a graduate of Harvard and a PhD from Columbia. That's pretty establishment. And I want to start off, Tom, by just asking you this question. You know, there's a lot of talk these days about the foolishness of fancy degrees. Now, I know I had to get a fancy degree because I can't get into medicine without that. I can't get a license. But what do you think about these fancy degrees and this move and talk about these degrees don't mean much at all, and sometimes they get degrees and the young people don't even get jobs and they end up with debt?
Things are much different today than they were when I was in graduate school 20 years ago. I mean, it's hard to remember, but in the 1990s, I remember all my friends getting out of school, they would just have an undergraduate degree in something like sociology, and it seemed like they automatically got a good job. Like, it seemed like you were set as long as you had gone to college. Now I think things are a bit different. Now, I went to get the degrees I got because I wanted to go into academia, and you can't be a professor without a PhD, and history departments are very hard to crack into. Right. You've got to have the most prestigious degree you can. But now that I'm out of academia working for myself, and much happier, by the way, I realize that the degrees do mean something for me, because when people have sort of views that you and I have, you need all the credibility you can get, because we are going up against the whole establishment. We're up against the left. We're up against the right. And for somebody to say the sorts of things that we say, they want to be able to dismiss us as being from the University of Hoboken. But when we're not, it makes it harder for them to do that.
That's a good point, but I want to mention the fact that you've written a lot of books and you're on the verge of releasing another one rather soon. But I was fascinated with a book you wrote, and if I'm not mistaken, rather quickly, and the one you did in 2009 when the crisis hit, and you wrote Meltdown, and of course I reviewed that. But the really tough question I have for you, who can write a book the fastest, you or Gary North?
Oh, it's hard to say, but he cheats because he works 16-hour days. I have 5 children. I have no intention of working 16-hour days. I'm going to spend my time with them. But it's funny that you mentioned Meltdown from 2009. It amazed me that that book on the financial crisis spent 10 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, and it's talking about Austrian economics and blaming the Fed for the financial crisis. You don't get a book like that on the bestseller list unless the groundwork has been laid for the public to receive this message. And I don't think that book would have had the success that it had if you hadn't paved the way for it by talking about the Fed when most people had never even, frankly, never even heard about it.
Well, you know, I think that helped, me talking about it helped. But I think your statement is correct. The groundwork had been laid by others, the Mises Institute and Murray Rothbard, and the books have been out. But I do think that due to the work of many people, it's almost miraculous how it came about, because I had been talking about the Fed, you know, since I first went to Congress in 76, but all of a sudden the university students that weren't being exposed at college started to know about this. So I think we can say that things are moving along in the right direction. But let me bring up the subject of your new book. I know it's not quite out yet. And I think it's fascinating what you're doing here. In many ways in the book, you're going to refute the people who badmouth us, who say things and challenge us, and why that is going to be so important, because I try to do that in a meager way. But the reason why that's so important, have you noticed, Tom, how many major articles, like just recently, The Guardian, big headlines, the libertarians are wrong. You know, they used to ignore us, but now they're attacking us. So don't you think that right now our enemies are on more of the defensive than they've ever been before?
Absolutely, because the way they like it is to have debates where one side is arguing that the tax rate should be 40% and the other side is arguing that it should be 41%. They like debates like that. They don't like debates where you and I are participating saying we shouldn't have an income tax, or they like the debate to be, should the Fed do this or should the Fed do that? They don't want to hear, maybe we shouldn't have a Fed. They don't want these fundamental questions to be asked. And so over the years, I've gotten a bit of a reputation as the guy who, when there's an article in Salon bashing us or an article on Slate bashing us, people send it to me and say, you've got to write a smash of a response. So I write these responses and everybody likes them. So I thought, well, since everybody likes them, I'm going to take all my responses to these people and put them together into a book. So we have to keep up our momentum, because you're right. This is discouraging. It's discouraging to read headlines about how the anti-interventionist mood in at least some wings of the Republican Party is beginning to dissolve, because now everybody who is respectable knows we have to go in there and go get ISIS. And so it is indeed frustrating. And of course, it's useful to remind people there wouldn't have been an ISIS in Iraq had there been no invasion in the first place. There is no way something like this could have had any foothold in Iraq in 2001, 2002. Impossible. I think it must be more frustrating for you than for me, because you've been warning the general public not only about the Fed and a coming financial crisis, but you told them that if you intervene in Iraq, the country's going to fall apart, you're going to have instability, the lunatics are going to fill the void. Every single thing you say comes true, and yet they want to consult all the idiots. They want to consult every interventionist wacko for advice about what to do next.
Of course, I wanted to bring up history and facts like this quite frequently during the debates and during the time I was in Congress. But I can remember, it's been several years now since I was on a Bill O'Reilly show. But there was a time on with Bill O'Reilly, and I wanted to bring up this very subject, that maybe our policies have consequences, maybe there is blowback, and we did this, and this is what happened. And, you know, he became angry, and he dismissed it. He says, I don't want to hear anything about history. And that was the answer. So they don't want to hear about it. So I would think you as a historian would resent, you know, that type of approach.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, you don't have to look that far back. In the mid-20th century, the State Department was saying that if you start intervening in the Middle East, you're going to create a whole lot of enemies for yourself that the United States doesn't have right now. Most Americans don't realize that after World War I, the United States actually still had such an excellent reputation in the Middle East that the Syrians, when they were polled, what country would you like to administer you as a League of Nations mandate, they overwhelmingly chose the United States. Now, that would never happen today. That's because of the interventions. The U.S. had an excellent reputation. Where did it go? You know, Islam has been around since the 7th century. But the U.S. was liked 100 years ago, and it's not liked today. Why is that? What is the missing ingredient? The ingredient was the intervention. And it's just like Mises said, in domestic policy, there'll be some intervention in the market. The government gets involved in health care, and it screws up health care, so now they intervene more with Obamacare, and they screw it up more. They never say, let's get rid of that original intervention. Well, likewise with foreign policy. The first intervention creates all kinds of chaos everywhere, and all they can think to do is intervene more. And meanwhile, they try and claim that you and I are left liberals because we don't want to intervene. All the best conservatives were always against this kind of utopian interventionist nonsense. And the fact is, Hillary Clinton is as hawkish as any Republican. There is no real debate on foreign policy in Washington.
The word intervention is one of my favorite words to try to describe, you know, what's going on, because we as libertarians don't want to be involved and intervene in the internal affairs of other nations. You know, somebody like Jefferson, a few of our early presidents mentioned that. And also, we're not very anxious, and matter of fact, we resent the idea of intervening in somebody's peaceful personal habits in life, regardless of whether we think they're good or bad or indifferent, and we don't want to intervene. At the same time, we don't want to intervene in the economy. And there's something that my colleagues in Congress would come up and say to me, and I've always marveled about this, and I'll give you a chance to be a psychologist there, and I analyze it. They would come up and very seriously say, that's rather amazing. The one thing we can say about you is you are very consistent. And I thought, well, what are they saying about themselves? Why do they do this? I've never quite figured that out. So maybe you have the answer.
Yeah, they're really all over the map. I mean, you can't figure out from one day to the next what they're going to favor. You know, and just today I'm recording the audiobook of my forthcoming book. I'm reading the book myself. I'm doing the audiobook. And I came across an old essay of mine about the anti-imperialists in the late 1800s, the very end of the 1800s. There was an organization in the U.S. called the Anti-Imperialist League, and it drew from people on the left and people on the right, and they all said, whatever our disagreements are, we know that imperialism is anti-American. And I came across two people in particular I found interesting, Edward Atkinson and Moorfield Story. They were both anti-imperialist, anti-interventionist, pro-gold standard, pro-laissez-faire, just like Ron Paul. That was their view. They didn't think that was inconsistent. They favor the free economy, and they also favor anti-intervention. They thought those things made sense. They thought that worked well together. And it's interesting to note, Moorfield Story was also the first president of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. He was white, but he was the first president of the NAACP. He was pro-gold standard, pro-laissez-faire, and anti-imperialist. I mean, that's a great but totally forgotten American tradition that you, Ron Paul, belong to and have helped to carry on into our own day.
Well, the point I'm trying to make is that they seem to praise me, be willing to praise me for being consistent, but they don't have any self-evaluation saying, well, why am I so inconsistent? But anyway, sorry, but we got to go, Tom, and thank you very much for being with us, and I'm sure we'll be talking shortly and involved in many of our projects, but thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Ron. Okay, everybody, remember, learn the history and economics they didn't teach you over at mylibertyclassroom.com using coupon code DISCOUNT in all caps for you guys. And if you plan to be with me for a while, you can get a lifetime subscription to libertyclassroom.com over at supportinglisteners.com. All right, tomorrow we're going to talk about the transition from communism in Poland. Very interesting question. Well, you got the government owning everything. How do you transition out of that? Very, very interesting. We're going to talk to an old friend from Poland who will tell us how it happened in the Polish case. So you'll want to join us for that. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.